Deutschlandfunk. Corso. Kunst und Pop.
We wore the mythology that we'd created and partly that the media placed on us, maybe a little bit too well. Generally speaking, Heroin kind of got the best of the band. I think to really boil it down to the simplest possible answer, years of touring, it kind of destroyed everybody. There's no way of sort of preparing for something like that. We never expected to become like a professional touring outfit in the first place. It all kind of like got thrust upon us. So our psychic defenses were weak, but I think we spent enough time in the wilderness before anybody noticed to develop a strong enough identity and a strong enough kind of aesthetic vocabulary to see us through the dark night of the soul that was Heroin. Anyway, it was a question of just getting out of the city, getting away from the vampires and rebuilding things in a hard drug-free zone, you know?
Was there a particular moment when you said, right, that's enough?
There wasn't really enough time to think about anything. So I think, again, this is why this album maybe appears to people more articulate, more dexterous, more imaginative, more refined, is because we finally had a place to live, our own little studio, and some time to string a few thoughts together. I remember the last 6 months of touring on the previous album campaign, it was like being in Vietnam or something, you know? It was just like survive one day at a time. I mean, that's a hyperbolic kind of like analogy, of course, but I'm not going to shy away from a little bit of hyperbole, but it was kind of like there was just a tunnel. At the end of every tunnel, there was another tunnel. And then at the end of all those tunnels, there was the prospect of being dropped by our label because we'd fired Saul, who was our musical director up to that point. And the label that we had at the time offered us a paltry, gestural kind of deal that was totally unworkable for my plan of rescuing the band up north. And then Domino stepped in and offered us something altogether more substantial and basically gave us a sort of second chance, I guess. But by the time we'd been through all that, I think we were pretty much certain that we had to do something really serious and make it about the music again and not about the kind of bullshit mythologizing that had surrounded us and that we'd fed into ourselves, you know?
And now this seemingly nihilistic band have a song called I Believe in Something Better. Is that song about what we just talked about?
No, that song is about Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. It's our attempt at an environmental song. We were kind of right at the end of the album and the label wanted one more kind of up-tempo track. And we thought, well, we've got to do an environmental song. You know, we were sort of envisaging a future where the environment has collapsed to such a degree that people start erecting bronze statues of Ted Kaczynski in public squares, you know, and they start teaching people about him in primary schools, that kind of thing. That's what we had in mind. So still pretty nihilistic.
Still nihilistic, yes. The first single, Feet, the most beautiful thing you've ever made, in a way. Still slightly disturbing. The lyrics seem to be about sex at first, then end with war and racism. And in the video, we see you as soldiers from 100 years ago, and you are stumbling naked through this wasteland to a kind of ruined Nazi palace. What is all that about?
It's about the racist abuse I grew up with as a teenager. I grew up in a really bigoted part of the UK. I grew up in a place called Cookstown in County Tyrone in Northern Ireland, where Protestants still hate Catholics and Catholics still hate Protestants. Now, me and my little brother were the ethnic minority in that town, so I was referred to as sand nigger and packy every day of my adolescent life. And I used to have the shit kicked out of me, and I used to have people spit in my face. And then eventually I channeled all that rage and disdain into music, and I found a constructive place for all of that rejection. And then last year, Pitchfork magazine decided to brand me a racist for satirizing Boris Johnson's disgusting comments about cleaning bodies off the beach in Libya so he can make way for a new Dubai. And I realized I've ended up, you know, coming full circle. Here they are attacking me again. And I was, as far as I knew, fighting the good fight as an artist, trying to describe the evil and the racism that I see in front of me in as visceral a way as possible so people can understand it more clearly. And then to have the largest music blog on earth basically try and destroy my career over said self-expression, I thought, well, here we are again, at war again. It never ends, you know? So for me, that song was kind of about retribution. I wanted to do something which was the absolute opposite of virtue signaling.
How did you arrive at the new sound then? I mean, it's one thing to say we got to clean up our act, we got to change, and another to put that into music. Which decisions did you make?
We finished the last album campaign and we were all exhausted and we all went our separate ways. I went to Southeast Asia, to wander around on my own for a few months. Nathan went to Mexico to do the same thing, and Saul went to New York to live with Sean Lennon. And towards the end of my stay, I got a call from Saul, or an email, and he asked me to come and record the Insecure Men album with him and to do lyrics for him, you know. And Nathan joined him as well to contribute to that album. So we were all upstate at Sean's, and it was a really kind of like jubilant kind of session for once. After all the pain of Fat White Family, here we were working on a completely separate project where the pressure felt completely removed. And after every session, we kind of had a little party together. And we were like, what should we do with the next Fat White thing, you know? Where do we go from here? And the idea crept in that we'd just do something pop, you know? We'd done kind of heroin dirge and this abrasive noise thing. You know, I guess the provocative thing to do next would be to do something brighter and danceable and kind of sexier, you know? And we listen to a lot of pop music, you know? We're not like purists in any way. We've always listened to ABBA and George Michael and Tina Turner and all this kind of stuff, you know? We just set about, like, how do we kind of remodel ourselves in that way? Because we're obviously not capable of it. We'll obviously fail, but it will be an interesting failure, whatever it is, you know? If we go in that direction, I think we were all just curious to see what would, you know, what it would, how it would pan out, you know?
And now you made it more accessible. I mean, I remember watching the video to Cream of the Young with all this offal on the table and you fooling around with the cream. I almost couldn't look at it because it was so disgusting. Was being shocking a means to an end, or was it fun in itself?
I think, I mean, this will sound preposterous, really, but I don't really think it was that shocking in any way, shape, or form. I think at that time, we were so sick of the sort of homogenized, safe as houses, box-ticking crap that had been floating around. Just any kind of gesture towards provocation would have been reacted to, you know, in some way. I think, I don't consider us that shocking or anything. I consider everybody else at that time to have been like tragically dull. And I think that sentiment is getting, it's getting worse, I think, actually, not better. I think people are becoming more and more afraid of humiliating themselves or making some sort of politically incorrect faux pas and generating the ire of the left-wing hate mob and all this kind of crap, you know. I think people are getting more and more afraid of actually sticking their necks out, you know. And none of that stuff really matters in art, you know. It's all about sticking your neck out and taking a chance. And you risk ridicule and humiliation by doing that. But that's a part of being an artist, I think.
And I suppose you went on stage with that same attitude or idea. I mean, a couple of years ago, a reviewer of The Guardian wrote, I read that, everyone should see the Fat Whites at least once before they die. I haven't yet, so what did I miss?
Well, I think we're in the business of managed chaos, and I don't think you're going to find too many harbingers of that particular philosophy anymore, because it's a really stupid thing to indulge. It's really dangerous. It had horrible repercussions for us all as individuals. It damaged everybody in profound ways that we're still wrestling with now. So I think what it was sacrifice on a fundamental level by the people involved, an idiotic sort of devil-may-care attitude towards our own bodies and popular culture itself.
Now that you're a different band in a way, how will your live shows change?
I think, like the record, they'll be more articulate. Everybody's kind of grown a little bit as a performer. I mean, personally, I'm just aching to get back to it now. I mean, for me, live performance is all about kind of a reckoning, you know. I like to run through all the most negative things that have ever happened to me before I get on stage. And it's like my way of kind of processing all that and not taking it out on people in my private life.
Who are your fans, as far as you can tell? What do you think? What do they get from you?
I don't know. I mean, who are my fans? I guess we have a lot of fans now of various esteem, you know, sometimes quite surprising. What they get from us, I guess, is, again, it's a kind of refuge for people who are sick of homogenized bullshit culture that, you know, this idea that you make art by public decree and that it shouldn't offend anybody. And I think we provide a healthy alternative to that. And I think it's everywhere these days, you know? It's like this virtue signaling thing again, you know? Bands like telling you to be nice to this person and that person, this patronizing kind of moralizing tosh, you know? And I can't stand that, you know? How many right-wingers are at home listening to BBC Radio 6 music? Zero. Preaching to the choir. We're basically the opposite of that.